Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Coaches, we have Jeff Van Gundy here today. And again, don't need to give you much of an introduction. Head coach of the New York Knicks, Houston Rockets, head coach of USA Basketball from 2017 on as they work towards World Cup and Olympic qualifying, and just a tremendous resource of basketball knowledge, and most famous over the last 10 years for being an NBA broadcaster that brings coaching to light and just celebrates coaching as a whole. So huge shout out to Chris Caputo, who was on the Basketball Podcast previously, who helped make this happen. Thank you and enjoy. Coach, is real special today to be able to have Jeff Van Gundy with us. Coach, welcome to the podcast. No introduction needed because we hear you every day on broadcasts and just a tremendous influence you've had on coaches throughout the world getting to listen to you talk about basketball in those broadcasts. And in addition to that, obviously a tremendous coach in the past, having been a head coach at the NBA level and just experience coaching at all different levels. So welcome to the podcast.
Really appreciate it.
Great to have you here and great to have you to be able to share the game with us. And coach, let's start with a little bit of a broad question, but just to get you started here, but you've had access to the best coaches in the world over the last little while, especially as a broadcaster. And I'm curious, what are some of the things you learned that you would take back to your coaching?
Well, I think if you study NBA basketball, it's constantly evolving and changing. I think the one thing that I wish I had been at the forefront on, but didn't take advantage of, was playing some zone defense in the NBA. And not an all the time thing or anything like that, but some of the players that I had, I think it would have been really effective to have played some zone defense, even going back to what the Lakers did back in the early 80s, an extended 1-3-1. I think has not been used. Flip Saunders, when he was at Minnesota in particular, used 1-2-2 extended. But I really like the 1-3-1, particularly when you have a big center, to try to keep him out of some pick and roll situations that sometimes can make him a negative. So that's the biggest thing that I wish I would have taken advantage of on some possessions with some players and against some opponents.
And I'm curious, did you use that a little bit with the USA basketball to be able to, again, change the pace of the game or change up the game in some way?
Not really, because that was so different in that you didn't have to worry about illegal defenses, obviously, in international basketball. So you could have played a more conventional zone. But because the preparation time was so limited, we chose to play exclusively man-to-man.
Does it pique your interest a little bit when you see people like Nick Nurse, you know, bust out a 1-2-2 half-court press and different things like that that are happening in the game? Because it does seem like over the last little while, coaches are starting to get a little bit more innovative at trying some of these things that in the past, maybe we would have seen just traditional half-court defense.
Well, Nick Nurse has big coaching balls. You know, I don't think at all worried about what others perceive him to be, or I don't think he's making those moves to be known as a creative coach. I think he's just trying to put his team in the best possible position to win. And the thing I've liked about his team, when he's done something different, whether it's a box and one, triangle two, whatever it may be, it's never taken away from his base defense, the man-to-man defense. They've consistently played aggressive, sound man-to-man defense. And because of that, I think it makes his changes sounder because you still have to guard the ball and they can do that. So I think that's hard to do with a team, to try a lot of different things while keeping your base defense sound and solid.
Well, it's such a good point, and obviously the experience of their team, but also the credibility that he has, having just won an NBA championship, has got to add to it as well. But I am curious, like as the stakes get...
I want to jump in on that.
Please.
I don't think that has anything to do with... He was doing that before he won championships. I actually think Nick Nurse, within his own team, he had credibility because he had been there. And they had seen his work. Now, it's different as an assistant, but they get a good handle on you from your time there as an assistant. And I think the reason they bought into Nick Nurse is because I don't think the success came and then the buy-in. I think the buy-in came because of his competence. Like, he was so competent at his job. And thus, because they knew they were in good hands, then the buy-in came in.
Love that. Love that. It's such a great point to be able to add. And I'm wondering the other part of that, there's no perfect path to becoming a head coach, and there's a lot of different paths, but also some of the advantages he may have had is that he's tried some of these things before as a head coach at different levels that he's been at. Is that sometimes an advantage for coaches that have kind of gone through different types of leagues or paths to be able to try some of these things under less pressure?
Well, I do think that most coaches feel the same pressure, whether you're in a G League game or a high school game, a small college game, or the NBA finals. I don't think, you know, I was a high school coach for a year. I don't remember feeling any more or any less anxious about how my team was going to play at the varying levels. I do think head coaching experience is so valuable that you can make many mistakes either at a lower level, which he did, right? Where, you know, he wasn't going to be criticized for over in England or the G League. And I also think it's critical that you have Hall of Fame players to bail you out of your early mistakes where you are the only one that knows that maybe the play call was wrong, the scouting report was wrong, the scheme you employed was wrong, but your Hall of Fame players bail you out of those poor decisions. And so you don't have to pay for your poor decisions with a loss. You can make your bad decisions. And because you have great players, they can overcome your bad decisions and you can win while learning. I think most people have to pay for their bad decisions with losses. I was fortunate when I took over the Knicks, I had a Hall of Fame player in Patrick Ewing and many, many other outstanding players. They did that for me. And I think in Nick Nurse's first year, I'm sure he would say, I didn't like that decision, but Kawhi Leonard was so good, or Kyle Lowry was so good, or Marc Gasol, Serge Ibaka, on down the line. They bailed me out because it's just, that's the normal course of things. But when you have an Atlanta Hawks team and you're Lloyd Pierce, every mistake you might make, you don't have a Hall of Fame player to bail you out of.
Well, this is why I'm such a fan of listening to you and in support of coaches and having empathy really for the process at all levels, because it's not as simple as sometimes people try and pretend it is. And the other part that goes with that is I'm curious from your perspective, because sometimes I do this, I post a play and say, hey, this is a great coaching play, but sometimes it's the players making the play, right?
I would say it's the one common denominator for all coaches that are considered great is they have Hall of Fame players attached to their name.
Yeah.
There's no other way around it. There's a lot of Hall of Fame players that may not have had Hall, but there's never been, quote, a Hall of Fame coach without Hall of Fame players. And it's always about the players. And the thing that about the NBA that I love is it humbles you. You could think it's you, and the moment you're stripped of players, I've never seen an NBA coach win a game. I know as an NBA coach, I felt I cost us our team games at times, but you never win a game. The wins are on the players, because there's a lot of great coaches at all different levels. And the only separation is your team and your players. Now, you just have to be sound and solid with your schemes, but you can win if you play zone, if you play man, if you run, or you play slow. There's so many ways to win, but you need really good players.
What do you think coaches do well that they don't get enough credit for?
Well, I think one of the myths is halftime adjustments. And so I always laugh, oh, they're great at halftime adjustments. So something's going wrong in the first half and you're going to wait to halftime to adjust? I mean, that's foolish. You're going to adjust the moment you think you have a better option. And I think that's what NBA coaches do well. I think the best ones make sure that they're getting the proper effort to execute what they think is best. And if they're not getting the proper effort, it's hard to change your plan because you're not giving the plan a chance to work. But I do think that if they're getting the proper effort and something's not working, NBA coaches are outstanding at getting on to what the next best thing is. And they're not as rigid nor stubborn as maybe a high school coach who maybe his players can only retain so much. And they can't really be good at option A and option B. I think because of all the games and all the repetitions, NBA players, even the dumbest ones, are pretty smart in that they can retain a couple different options. And I think because you're playing the same players over and over again, year after year after year, you can learn personnel and you sort of know how to guard a little bit better. And so I think NBA coaches do a really good job of not waiting, quote, for halftime to make adjustments.
So with that, I'm curious how much of it is improvised somewhat at the NBA level because you don't have as much practice. Obviously, you have game day shoots, you have video sessions. Is there more improvisation because of that, because you're dealing with smarter players, smarter coaches, but then out of necessity as well to make some of these changes?
I don't know about improvisation. I think most people, now Nick Nurse, like said, he never practiced the box and won in the finals and he did it at a timeout. I think there are very few coaches that would feel comfortable doing that, but maybe that was born out of the necessity of being down too. I think it's more, you may not need as much practice time to put something in. Whereas in college, I'm always interested in how people use practice time. I wish I could go back to my high school coaching year, knowing what I know now, and get more to the nuts and bolts of what wins and what loses than what I did. And I think that's what NBA coaches do. I think they do a great job of using their time to put the players in the best possible position to win. And that may be able to be done in a, you know, hour shoot around. You know, I don't think NBA players require as long to be able to retain some knowledge that may go directly to winning or losing.
Yeah, it's a great point about retention, and also a great point about what I would call fluff is that sometimes because coaches at other levels have more practice time, say in college, that you tend to kind of do more fluff potentially. Not saying they don't think it's valuable, it just may not be as valuable. And whereas in the NBA, you have to get right to the point.
Well, I agree. I was talking to a former great college coach just yesterday, and that was his point. He was being self-critical. And this is like an all-time, probably a near Hall of Fame college coach. And he said the same exact thing. He said, if he had one thing to do over again, it would be he would have used his practice time better. Because now that they can coach year around, it's implausible to me that they should ever feel crunched for time in practice. Now, college kids don't have as many game repetitions, obviously, and they're, especially at the high major level, they're consumed by their futures more than being consumed by the present. And so I think high major college coaching is the hardest coaching there is. But I take what this coach was saying to me, that streamlining what he should have been doing in practice would have allowed him to have some better plan B options against some opponents.
We've had many college coaches on this podcast say a similar thing about the extra practice time, that almost they feel like they're redundant the whole year even. And one thing that has been talked about with some of them is the fact that it gives them an opportunity to give more game-like repetitions within practice or within the off season. Speaking back to the point that you made about them not having enough game repetitions, because they don't play as many games as the NBA, obviously. So you can get them more of these game-like repetitions if you're doing it in practice. And I'm wondering if that's what the coach was referring to, too, about letting them play more basketball.
Play more. Yes. Yeah. You know, the one thing in my first year of college coaching, and it struck me from day one, I came from a Catholic high school. I had good players, and I go to Rick Pitino at Providence as his grad assistant. And I swear it wasn't a week before, like, we had started, because back then, you know, fall was strictly fall conditioning. There was no 2 hours a week. This was back when, you know, the rules were clearly the demarcation was conditioning, right? So we start practice, and in the first week, we had already played more 5-on-5 in 1 week full court than I had done maybe my whole year in high school. And I'm like, that's how you learn. The game's played 5-on-5. And it got us in great shape. I thought an undersold part of that was it was a great evaluation tool for who could play and who couldn't play. And then you know, your decision-making is based on that. The game is about decisions and making the right ones more than your opponents do. And so it hit me. This guy played more 5-on-5 in my 1 year than I think any other coach of his time played 5-on-5. And I think that's directly related to his experience in the NBA. He had come from the Knicks as an assistant coach, and I think he had adopted many of the structures of practice and getting rid of what you just termed fluff. It was quickly to the bread and butter of what was going to make us win and how he wanted to play.
Well, you nailed it, Coach. In our pre-conversation, when we exchanged a few emails, that's exactly what I was referring to about teaching methodology and the advancements and the evidence of this idea of, as you said, decision-making. The other part that people don't understand about decision-making is it's preceded by perception. So you perceive, you decide, and then you execute the skill or the decision. So if we're not playing offense versus defense, whether it's 5-on-5, 3-on-3, et cetera, then we're not getting those repetitions that transfer to the game.
I couldn't agree more. I am so tired of seeing 1-on-0 drills. Like, obviously, they have a place. But if you're a young player, like, I'll just go back to me as a player. I was an absolute bitch against chairs and cones. It was those other players that made me a mediocre player. And I wish I would have just played all the time. I don't even care who it was against. Just grab people, play 3-on-3, 4-on-4, learn how to play, make decisions. You know, a lot of it isn't, you know, the actual skill. It's when to use the skill. Like, you know, and I think I watch college basketball somewhat. I have some teams I like to watch. And when I'm watching, it's like guys pull shots out and try to use just because they practiced it versus this is the right time or the right area on the court. And it's mind-boggling to me that we can have so many, quote, trainers of basketball, and they never or rarely allow the people they're training to play.
Well, I'm a big proponent of what you're saying, and huge, huge. In fact, that's my wheelhouse. So, and I had to laugh about your reflection on your playing time, because my wife actually said this on a podcast when I had her on talking about it. She played 5 years of college because you had 5 years in Canada, but she said three-man weave was my jam, but I wasn't as good in the game. And it's so true, because the three-man weave doesn't transfer any information for her to play the game better.
No, it's just like you hope you maybe get warmed up, I guess, or maybe, you know, like if it's a communication drill or whatever you're trying to get. But like, to me, again, I always reflect back to Rick Pitino. If I was a coach in college, I would have, I think, the shortest practices of anybody, because I don't think I would coach as an NBA coach, and it would be hard, it would be fast, it would be challenging, and it would be 5-on-5 for the majority of time.
Can I tell you that I have done this for whole seasons? I played 5-on-5 every minute of practice. And do you know what the other side benefit of this is, which is a huge benefit, is the players loved it. But the agreement was I could stop at any time to be able to coach things, and then I could create constraints. That means set up situations from which the 5-on-5 started so that we could actually organize what we wanted to work on. But the players loved it. They enjoyed every part of it. And we had a great season. We didn't lose anything not doing the 1-on-0.
Well, I'll say this. I like what you're saying, because, again, anything that players like that is also challenging is going to be good for them. You know, you can't just go by what your players like, because there has to be demands to do the hard things, because very few people want to do the hard things. But if you can find a manner and a format which you can demand and they enjoy it, you're going to have a level of motivation instead of having to prod people consistently to do what's right for the team. And that's practice hard and pass the ball, right? So, and I think over time, another benefit is it makes it clear the pecking order on your team and who should play, where the ball should go to, at what pace do you best play at. I think all of that provides answers and feedback to a coaching staff that's not provided when you play maybe one scrimmage a week and you're trying to get ready for your first game. And so when I was working at USA Basketball, because we had to try to get everything in so quickly, we basically put in everything the first night. And the college coaches that I worked with were like, "You're going to put in everything?" And I said, "Yeah." And then the whole idea was always whole part whole, right? But a lot of coaches say that from a teaching methodology, but really what they coach in is part whole instead of whole part whole. And so it's interesting to me. I made the same mistake when I was a high school coach. I wish I could have that year back, because I think we could have had a better year.
So we used to host Division I games in Canada when I coached at the University of Windsor. So we would have 3 or 4 practices to get ready to play a Division I team on a foreign tour. And it's exactly what you said with USA Basketball. We had to get right to the point. We introduced everything right away, and we went 5-on-5 right away. And then from the 5-on-5, we would determine what we needed to go back to and break down part. And I thought we were the best as a group when we did that. And then from that, we learned that, hey, this makes sense because it connects ideas right away to players.
Yeah, listen, I'm all in. I don't even think it's, you know, like looking back to when you played, like, did you learn more from a structured 3-on-3 or like 1-on-1 full court ball handling or a 2-on-2 situation? Or did you learn from 10 people being out on the floor and how do I play this situation or that situation, or what's my role? What are my greatest strengths? You know, I just think it's the only way to actually teach and learn.
So there's evidence-based research behind this too. It's called Hard First Instruction. A researcher, Joan Vickers, who pioneered some of this stuff like 30 years ago, it's not new. But anyways, my point to this is a lot of good coaches do this intuitively. And not to bring your brother up, of course, but tremendous coach. I got a chance to watch him run practices at Detroit there. And most of their practices were 3-on-3, 4-on-4. And I hadn't seen that much at the NBA level from the observations. But it immediately connected with me that he understood what his players valued and what they enjoyed about practice.
Right. And because of that, you know, and I would say probably most of the 3-on-3, 4-on-4 work was centered around defensive concepts, because, you know, you're trying to overload the defense with having to cover more ground. But I think who among us, and I think this generation, though, is different, Chris. I think guys, like I'll go back to when I first came to the NBA. One of the things that stood out to me was in 1989, I go to my first NBA practice. And after practice, organically, people just paired up and played one-on-one. Never spot shooting, never doing. They would work on their moves one-on-o, but they weren't just spot shooting, right? But they played one-on-one all the time after practice. And fast forward to when I came to the Rockets in 2003, it still persisted for a little bit, but now I watch no one plays one-on-one, just organically. I think they like this workout mentality, you know, get your yoga pants on and work out versus compete. And so I wonder if you competed as much now, if they would like it as much now. I don't know about that, but I do know it would be good for them. And obviously you have to pace your team correctly and you have to moderate the amount of contact that you have, particularly in the NBA season with games coming up so much. But I wonder if the NBA player would like that as much as I know the older NBA player would have liked. They hated drills. They loved to play.
So let's remove the NBA for a second, because we're going to come back to that to answer or talk about that, because that comes back to workload management and some of those words. But let's just say college and below. You've already kind of answered that, because you said already less practice time to get connection and transfer. So you could practice less. So you could manage your players and play more, but you'd be practicing less because you'd be getting right to the point. And that's what the Hall of Fame coach said. And that's kind of what you've said already, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I think Brad Stevens, one of his goals was always to be on the floor less as a college coach, be on the floor less with practice time than any other team in the nation. And I'm not sure, I never watched him practice in college, but I think what he was saying was exactly what you're driving at right there, is that because you're on the floor less doesn't mean you've done less or accomplished less. It just means that you've gotten done what you think is necessary to win. And I think, again, if I had one thing that I could have done differently in high school, it would have been to practice less and play more.
If it's okay, I'm going to dig into this a little bit even more. So what the question you said about the spot shooting, which again, I've seen, those are confidence and comfort reps is how I phrase them. That's for a player being confident and comfortable. But you know what they're not? They're not learning and they're not challenging or loading or development reps. And that's where you're saying when we're missing one-on-one. So I've encouraged coaches throughout the world that I've talked to start practice with players self-organizing one-on-one. Because you're right, they won't do it on their own. Because this generation hasn't had that opportunity to go to the playground and self-organize. It's all been organized by people. Does that make sense to you that as a coach, though, we have to organize the one-on-one, but we want them playing one-on-one?
I have never thought about them self-organizing, but anything that they take ownership in is going to be probably as good as what you can organize, as long as they're competing at a high level. And again, I would reserve the right as a coach to, you know, say where we're going to play from. Is it going to be from the elbow, the post, you know, beyond the 3-point line, a tighter catch, how many dribbles? I'll tell you, one of the best things we ever did for intensity, and it was slower as far as number of repetitions, but it absolutely shot the intensity through the roof, was we played one-on-one with three different groups at one basket. So everybody saw every repetition. So we'd have a low post rep. Well, they would stay within their group of four. So we'd have four at the low post, four on the wing, four at the high post, you know, and so the low post guys would go. Now, we also played one-on-one differently. We played always to one basket. So it didn't stop when you got to stop. You had to then take it and score or get fouled. And if you missed, the original offense could get the ball back. We thought it was a much better conditioner. And again, trying to link a sustained effort together, not just one effort and stop. So I loved when you had to get your team intensity to a higher level. And this was a Bill Musselman thing from way back that Tom Thibodeau gave me: bring everybody to one basket and everybody gets to watch everybody's rep. And very rarely in front of their peers are they going to not go all out. Instead of having, you know, one basket over there with an assistant, another basket over here, I like that very much.
I love that you brought this up because that speaks to the art of coaching. Because what I traditionally learned through, you know, skill acquisition, motor learning, is we have to maximize their learning time. So breaking them up into all these groups gets them more reps, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's tremendous value to what you said, bringing them together because, again, this shared ownership, this motivation. So that's the art of this, right? We've got to figure out what works best to be able to get your messages across.
Hey, Coach, going to interrupt this podcast for a brief message from show partner, Simply Safe. With home security, there's two ways you can go about protecting your home. There's the traditional way, where you wait weeks for a technician to do a messy installation that costs a small fortune. Or there's the other way, Simply Safe. Simply Safe is everything you need in a home security system. It's award-winning protection, two-time winner of CNET Editor's Choice Award. Simply Safe blankets your whole home in safety. You get comprehensive protection for your entire home. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. Entry, motion, and glass break sensors guard inside. You barely notice it's there. But what's truly remarkable is you can set up this system all by yourself. Anyone can do it. It takes 30 minutes to an hour tops, and there's absolutely no trade-offs to your safety. You'll have an army of highly trained security experts ready to dispatch police to your home at a moment's notice 24/7. And it's only 50 cents a day with no contracts. It's why The Verge calls Simply Safe the best home security system. Go to simplysafe.com/team today and you'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you go to simplysafe.com/team. That's simplysafe.com/team.
Correct. And there's no one way to do it or one way that it will always generate the same type of response. As much as I believe in them knowing what's coming in practice, so you're not constantly learning new drills to teach the same skills, I do believe throwing an occasional curveball that they're not suspecting generates more interest and more attention span. And so I understand more reps. I think sometimes depending on where you're at in a season, less reps but better reps are more important than more reps.
Love that. Love that. I want to just bring up one more point about this, about playing basketball in practice. Is I feel, and I argue to coaches all the time, that this helps you become a better coach because you're constantly doing two-way coaching in practice. You're coaching offense, defense, all these things all at the same time, and you're actually getting more game reps that transfer for you as a coach to the game as well because you're coaching the game in practice. Whereas me coaching three-man weave in practice doesn't help me in the game as a coach.
I hadn't thought about it like that, but I agree completely. I think one of the biggest things and skills you're trying to develop as a practice coach, and that will gain your players' trust, is if you can see all 10 players on the court on every trip. So when you stop it, you can make quick multiple points to multiple players on the same stop of possession. So, you know, that you noticed player X not rotating properly, player Y didn't block out, player Z did a good job of getting back. In all those things, being able to see 10 players is critical to your coaching in practice and so, and in the game. And so what you're saying gives, obviously it would give you more chances and opportunities to see all 10 players the more you play 5-on-5.
Well, I guess my question then comes back to this, is how do we overcome some of these cultural and historical norms that exist in basketball? And it seems to exist in other sports too, so don't get me wrong, but we're talking about basketball.
Well, I think people are very slow to change if they've won a lot. Because I don't think when you win, it's that whole premise of good being the enemy of great. If you're winning, you may be slow to say, I need to change. But I think all of us should evaluate every year on things that we can do better and not be seduced by good enough, but try to push ourselves to even greater heights. And I still remember there was a tremendous, tremendous Division III coach in California where I grew up at Redlands named Gary Smith. And he had always played methodical, Bob Kloppenberg switching defense his entire career at Redlands. And they had won. The moment he got tenure, he scrapped the methodical and played like as fast as any team in the country. And I don't know if we should always wait for the security blanket of guaranteed contracts to try to play to what we think is best and best for our team and best for our program and best for yourself too, to challenge yourself to continue to grow and improve and not be, again, not allowing good to prevent you from chasing greatness.
Love that. Love that. And it's just that question you're asking, is there a better way? It doesn't mean you're wrong. It just means, is there a better way to be able to move forward with what you're doing? So love that. Internationally, coach, now having had that, I mean, you've obviously watched the international game for a long time, but having coached as recently as year 2017 is when you started with USA Basketball, I believe, on this new journey. What has changed for you now having coached internationally in terms of your coaching philosophy or your technical tactical approach to the game? Anything?
Well, I think, again, it would all be based on who you have as players. But I think, again, there's a lot to learn from international basketball. I think the NBA should adopt many of their rules. I think their rules make total sense comparatively to the NBA's. So I like that very much. I think from my own vantage point, I really like some of offensively how they have some unique actions, but in general, how willing they are to move without the ball. And I think third, they place a much higher emphasis on offensive rebounding, particularly from the perimeter, than any NBA team. And it's gotten me to think of, and I did this with the USA basketball. If I coached again, I've never emphasized offensive rebounding. And I absolutely would going back to try to generate extra possessions, particularly to create those habits where you're playing the most high leverage games, you need extra possessions.
And again, I think a lot of the analytics play that out, but the game hasn't changed that way at the pro level yet, at the NBA level, I should say. But it's such a great observation. I'm wondering the other part of that is you having gone through this really short process and really fluctuating rosters, you can speak now to high school coaches and AAU coaches, all these different coaches that have to throw teams together in a really short time. So I'm wondering if you have any advice to them in ways that, I mean, we already talked about the play basketball part of it, but other ways to be able to bring your team together in a really short time period.
Well, again, and this goes back to like Pat Riley's approach, Rick Pitino, the value of playing 5-on-5 and getting in great, great condition. Pat Riley, is being direct and honest with the team members, roles, never avoiding conflict. And I don't mean in a negative way. I mean in a positive way. Bill Parcells said one time that conflict clears the air. And I think even better than that is direct and honest communication clears the air and prevents problems or brings problems to a head earlier and they don't fester. And listen, high school coaches have a really difficult job because they have to deal with parenting that is so different. Sports parents are so different now, and they're so problematic for the most part that maybe some people are reluctant to be as direct and honest, but I still feel if you play basketball more, you get in great shape because of it, and you have clear and direct, honest communication to let everybody know exactly how you see things, I think it'll allow you to put a team together, get your best players on the floor. And one of the things that I think is underdone at all levels for so many varying reasons, play your best players more. That leads directly to winning. One of the great things that Nick Nurse has done in Toronto, he plays his best players all the time. They don't play. If there's an injury, that means they're just going to play their best players even more. They don't try to force feed guys that aren't ready to help them win, because he understands that if you play somebody 14 minutes in a game that's not ready, you can lose that game because of those 14 minutes. I really admire him. I think it's underdone now. Everybody's always thinking about how many minutes are played in the realms of fatigue or trying to appease parents. Play your best players more if you want to win more.
Coach, let me bring you back to the honesty part first. And I'm just curious whether it's Pat Riley, yourself, other coaches you've been around, what are the best methods to be honest? Is it one-on-one? Is it in the support of film? Is it in front of the whole team? What are the best methods that you've seen?
I think it's always and always. Again, it may be a different time and sensitivities may be higher now by all parties, but again, I think players have to get comfortable with one-on-one communication. I think the adage about the film doesn't lie is true. They have to be willing to take a good, honest, receptive look at themselves. I think you have to be able to hold everybody accountable in front of the group. You can't have a hypersensitive group if you're going to win and not be able to talk to each individual in front of their peers. I think that's nonsensical. So I think you have to be able to do it in all ways. And small groups, I always found, was important too, particularly with your best players, to try to get buy-in from them to then help sell your message to the rest. So I think you have to be able to, and they, more importantly than how you do it, it's getting them to, when they walk through the door, listen and honestly evaluate what you're saying as a coach. And I think the whole idea about an open door policy is fantastic. And I think I got better and better at that. Any player could walk in and tell me exactly what they felt. The only thing that we had to have an agreement on was after they got done telling their truth, I would get my chance to tell my truth to them. It can't be one-way communication. It has to be back and forth, but everybody has to understand at the end of the day, the head coach has to make hard decisions. And the one thing he's going to always do as a head coach is try to make the decisions that he feels gives his team their best chance of winning. I do not understand or know when we went from it's all about the team, the team, the team. To this, I hear NBA teams brag about this always. We're player centric. We're player centric. Like, that's a good thing. That just spawns even more selfishness. Like, you guys are here for me versus we're here for each other. I do not understand the player centric model versus the team centric model.
It's such a great point. And going to that other point that you made about Nick Nurse playing his best players more, I'm curious your perspective on coaching your best players more. Do you find at the NBA level and your international experience most recently, the best players, do they want to be coached? Because I think we spend too much time coaching, not to say we shouldn't coach 8 to 12 or 12 to 15, but we don't spend enough time probably coaching our best players at other levels.
Well, the one thing I was always, when I first came to the NBA and I watched, you know, different, you know, coaches in the league and, you know, would read their stuff and their teams, what's going on with their team. So many NBA players would say, when a coach would talk in generalizations, they would say, call out names. Who are you talking about? Because when you talk in generalizations sometimes, you know, people don't understand. They don't think you're talking to them. And yet, when those same players would call out names and you called out their names, they may be less receptive. I know this. My best players that I've ever coached, I've been so fortunate that they had the right amount of stubbornness versus coachability. You can't be too coachable and you can't be too stubborn. You're always walking a fine line to be a best player. And I agree. Coaching 10, 11, 12 hard while allowing 1, 2, and 3 to get away with mistakes that beat you makes no sense to me. And if you can't coach 1, 2, or 3 hard on your team, then you've got the wrong guys and you need to make changes, because you will never win if your best players don't have the right amount of stubbornness versus coachability.
I imagine I know your response a little bit to this, but is being receptive to feedback, is that a teachable skill that we can teach players how to better receive feedback?
I think so. I think most things can be improved if there's enough repetitions and a solid base. So you have to give your kids or players a chance to be receptive by giving them honest feedback, by not always doing what is a positive coaching alliance thing of, you know, one praise, a negative, and then praise at the end. Sometimes you just got to get to the point, just like you do in practice. That's unacceptable. I don't have to say, I'm glad you showed up to practice on time. You have to sprint back in transition or we're going to lose our ass. But I do like that you threw away your Gatorade cup. Like, no.
Get rid of the sandwich approach. Yeah. Get rid of the sandwich approach. No, I agree.
Too much smoke is being blown up players' ass, so they don't have to deal with coaching. And then when you get into a game situation and in the height of these most pressurized moments, and you give some honest feedback, and that's their first time hearing you direct, honest, without the fluff of this positive coaching alliance method, then maybe they'll have a chance to, if they give constant, and I'm not talking about being critical for being critical's sake, I'm saying, look at what's happening on the practice floor. When a guy does something good, tell him it's good. So he knows I'm only getting praise when I deserve it. And when it's unacceptable and needs to be changed, that's what you tell them too. So that they know you're being forthright with them. There is so much wasted time to me in blowing smoke up players' asses for things that don't need to be praised. It's nonsensical to me.
Absolutely. Nonsensical. And you don't get your point across.
I don't believe in, you know, you're being too negative or you're being too positive. I don't understand that. If I'm telling you the truth as I see it, it will never be too negative and it'll never be overtly positive because I'm just telling you the truth as I see it. It's not meant to be positive or negative. It's meant to be, this is the truth as how I see it. This is how we're going to win. These actions that you're doing will help us win, or these actions that you're participating in will get us beat. That's it. To me, there is no positive or negative. It's honesty.
Love that. I've said it to many times to players. It's like, do you really think I'm trying to sabotage you? Like, what would be my benefit in trying to take you down as a player? How would that help me as a coach and help our team win? Like, it's not that. You're trying to help everybody, but you're trying to help that individual player in that moment. Love the way you phrased that. I just was going to jump to some of the topics that you brought up, so which I think are necessary to talk about. And one of them is load management. So let's start there. Is this a real thing that we should be thinking about at all levels? I mean, physiologically, there's evidence behind this. But how would you approach this now as a coach?
Well, I think the number one or one of the most important jobs any coach has is to pace his team correctly. And again, that's another Parcells line from way back. This is not new. Pacing your team has always been vital to your overall success. Not every practice minute or game minute is the same. I think most of the stuff that we're talking about as far as load management is non-scientific as it relates to basketball. And I think a lot of it is, again, not allowing coaches to push players out of their comfort zone. Now, that being said, one of the problems I believe is that both the medical staffs, the training staffs, and the coaching staffs have gotten so large as it's hard to come up with a consensus of what's best. But to eliminate the coach from decisions, I'm not talking health decisions. I'm just talking about, do we need to practice today? How hard do we need to practice? Eliminating coaches from that and trying to individualize everything in a team sport is, again, to me, where you can gain a great advantage against opponents. Playing your best players more and understanding it's about the team first, that you may well benefit from a day off, but our team needs you to practice to set the right tone for tomorrow, and I'll get you some less repetition, but you need to be ready to practice. I think by practicing more than your opponents and by playing your best players more than other teams will, if you have a middling type of talented team, that's how you can steal some wins.
Great. I'm on board. Early specialization, coach.
Awful. There's no other word. I would always, if I was out recruiting in college, I would always look for players that played football. I love the idea of guys who have learned to absorb contact. One of the worst things about some of our best high school players is they've never been challenged physically. They've never hit the floor. And they don't know how to withstand some uncomfortableness with more physicality. And so football players by nature have had to absorb hits and absorb contact because that's the game. I love guys that play more than one sport. And I think one of the reasons with this early specialization, I think you're seeing more and more injuries because of it. I think you're seeing guys who are not going to be able to last as long if they do are fortunate enough to be pros because they've just pounded the same body parts over and over again. Again, I think it would take a strong parent or a strong AAU coach or even, to me, strong college coaches and strong NBA coaches to say, no, we're not training year-round. Some of the things that bother me the most, Chris, are when I hear an NBA player said, I work out three times a day in the offseason. How about this? How about take 6 weeks off with light exercise, come back and work out once a day on the court and in the weight room 4 days a week so you can practice every time you practice in your season and you can play in every game. Why would we want guys to practice so much in the offseason and be unavailable in the season?
So a number of things come up there, and I agree. So you already mentioned parents, and the parent issue is a huge problem at the youth level, clearly, when you're dealing with this early specialization, because often their understanding is this helps their son or daughter improve more to be able to get the scholarship, to be able to play on the next level team, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any words to the parents about that?
It's just not right. You know, I mean, I don't know. You have to be open-minded enough. Now, look, some kids, they don't want to play more than one, right? I mean, but I would always encourage a basketball player to run track if they don't want to play football. Or lacrosse is another growing sport that I say have at it. Again, contact, physical, developing strength through contact is such a critical aspect of success in any sport. Balance. You're not losing anything by not specializing, particularly, I would say, up and through your freshman, sophomore year of high school.
So I brought up this a few times with some NBA people and saying, because they practice so little, and you talked about this offseason for an NBA player, they practice so little in season, I'm on board. They should take some time off. And then I'm curious if they should organize kind of like the NFL has these, what do they call them, mini camps or something like that, where they actually OTAs, get to practice.
Yeah,
OTAs, where they actually get to practice, like full practice, offense versus defense, not all these comfort and confidence reps. Because again, like some of these players aren't getting these perceptual, these decision training reps in the offseason because they don't practice in season. And then the offseason, as you said, they work with their trainers, right? And that's not necessarily coaching. It's not necessarily development.
Yeah, I would say this. I don't know if the players would participate.
Of course. Yeah.
I would rather have, instead of the summer league, if I went back and coached an NBA team, the first thing I would try to eliminate is summer league. It's a waste of time and expense. I would try to get, and I would use that to practice for 2 weeks and try to get my veterans to come back in. So we wouldn't do it, you know, around July 4th. Maybe we'd do it, you know, the first week of August, and not take one of these fake team building things to the Bahamas and fish. We would actually like practice. By eliminating summer league, I would much rather put my time and resources in, not to 12 free agents that we're in a cut, but to the rookies that we've drafted or we believe in, and to my veterans.
Love it. I mean, we're both speaking from the ideal utopian world. And obviously, Summer League, the problem is they make money, right? So somebody's making money off it.
It's the teams don't make money. The teams don't make money. They lose money on Summer League.
Somebody's making money. So the teams aren't. Okay. There you go. Yeah. Then let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's do it. So the weight room. You talked about the weight room not being as common thing in basketball culture compared to other sports.
Listen, I believe in strength training. I think it's a tremendous, when you see your body changing for the better, I think it brings out a lot of confidence. I think the way I would term it, we want to be the lightest and leanest and strongest and fastest we can be. And whatever like gives us the best chance to be those four things, that's what I want implemented. You know, you also have to be healthy. But again, where you choose to like invest the majority of your time. I know a lot of people do a lot of corrective work or prehab work, which makes sense to me, depending on the allotted time for it. But I think the weight room is critical to improvement. You've got to build your body. You've got to have confidence that your body can hold up. for 82 games and then playoffs. And the weight room is an important component. How you achieve those goals doesn't have to be the same for every person.
So I guess one last thing I've got to ask you, because I'm sure you get asked this in almost every interview, but the influx of data, sports science data or analytics data in terms of the game, how do you feel that's impacting things?
Again, sports science, just that term gives like there's clear, concise, no-brainer answers. And that couldn't be any further from the truth as it relates to basketball. There's always going to be information that should be interpreted by the experts and passed along to the coaching staff. And it's vital that there is a back and forth communication between the two. But you will, I know it is for a lot of teams in the NBA, no one will ever convince me that if it's not a straight health question, this guy is injured versus this guy is tired. Injured, you sit and you're with the training staff. I have nothing to do with that as a coach. But if you're tired as a coach, it's up to you, after you've listened to people, to make decisions. The analytics part, more information is better. Again, there is no clear-cut answer for how you best play. It's individualized. So this idea that all mid-range jump shots are the same and should be not taken. Well, if you look at the champions from the last few years, Kevin Durant, Kawhi Leonard, et cetera, you're going to find guys that are highly efficient from that area and take those shots. And we're allowed to take those shots by their very astute, smart head coaches. I think too often this whole analytics thing becomes as much a team thing and how you view it versus, okay, that's good data. Now let's look at everybody individually. Not every mid-range jump shot is the same. Not every drive to the rim is the same. Not every corner three is the same. And I think what you have to do is get your players to play their very best when their best is needed. And so how do you give them the right amount of data? How do you coach into that data? And then how much do you trust your eyes as well? I think that goes back to the art of coaching that's being stripped away from too many coaches at too many levels by people who just want you to adhere to a rigid set of numbers.
Love that. Love that you brought up the art and science of coaching. That's always, any course I ever took or any education I had was always the art and science. It's a blend of both. So I couldn't agree more. Coach, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. Tremendous, tremendous insights into coaching in the game. And I know we're all excited to hear you again or watch you again when the games get back and started. So thank you for spending some time with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
I am happy to announce that the Best in the West Coaching Clinic video series is now available for download. Get 11 full clinic videos featuring multiple sessions by Mike McKay, Alex Sarama, Yorick Michaels, Chris Oliver, plus single sessions from Lisa Tomadais, Shawnee Harley, and Dave Taylor. Go to www.bestinthewestclinic.com to watch a trailer and to learn more. Learn modern coaching ideas, not just on what to coach, but on how to coach as well, from some of the best coach educators currently sharing the game. A number of coaches have already reached out to me, grateful to be able to stimulate their coaching with so many unique ideas never shared or discussed on most coaching DVDs. Go to www.bestinthewestclinic.com to get these videos to download to be able to watch in the comfort of your home.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues
so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.